Mormon Stories Podcast is a production of the Open Stories Foundation. All donations to Mormon Stories are fully tax deductible and go directly towards keeping the podcast alive and towards building a community of support for Mormons like you. To support the podcast or to join the community, please become a monthly subscriber today at mormonstories.org. Alrighty, well, we're back with the fourth hour of this marathon discussion with Brant Gardner. Again, I'm just going to repeat this for a number of reasons, because it's an excellent book, because Greg Kofor deserves our support, and because it's a special offer that we want to offer to you. We're talking about The Gift and Power, Translating the Book of Mormon by Brant Gardner. You can purchase this book at a discount at Greg Kofor Books. That's Greg, KOFFORD.com. You can type in M Stories, all in caps, M Stories. And if you do, you'll get a discount on the book. The book definitely covers a lot more in depth than what we've been able to discuss, even in 3 hours so far. Is that right, Brant?
Oh, yes.
Yeah. So even if you've enjoyed this conversation, the book goes into much more depth. So anyway, if you want to support Brant, or if you want to support Greg Kofor, or if you want to support Mormon Stories, or just Mormon scholarship in general, I would really encourage you to purchase the book. Okay, so my guess is this part's going to go really quickly. But again, just for our listeners, I did an interview with Michael Coe, who is a Yale archaeologist specializing in Mesoamerican archaeology, and we basically covered. We basically covered all the different issues with the Book of Mormon that critics have found. And so I'm going to really just rifle through them. And Brant, if you want to, you can just invoke concepts that we've already discussed in just a few words to say, well, sure, that one I would ascribe to this, and that one I ascribe to this. You know, we don't necessarily need to spend a lot of time on any one of these things. Okay.
Okay.
Is that all right if we do it?
Sure.
Okay. So animals, you know, the classic example is horses. The Book of Mormon, you know, we have no evidence that Native Americans had horses, but instead that the Spaniards brought horses over with them when they explored and worked with Latin America, such that we wouldn't expect to find people between 600 BC and what, 1000 AD, you know, in the Americas with horses. Is that all fair so far?
Sure.
So why do horses exist in the Book of Mormon?
And that's probably a good one to take just, you know, a fraction longer with, because then we can say, yeah, you remember the horse, it applies to everything else.
Right.
The first thing is the concept of a functional translation, where the word that we have may or may not be the precise representation of what was in the plate text. Again, going back to the concept of a candle being translated into the King James Version. We have the word candle. It isn't in the original text. It's an anachronism and doesn't belong there. But it relates to some source of light. So there's every reason to believe that there was a source of light on the plates, or not on the plates, but you know, in the original text, and we just happen to have the wrong vocabulary. The question is then, you know, if it is possible that the word horse is an anachronistic translation, can we tell that by looking at the text? And so you've got two ways of approaching something. And the first one would be to say, oh, well, I'm going to invoke anachronism of text, and therefore I don't have to deal with a horse. That's really quite unfair, because it could have been a horse. What you have to do in any text like that is examine it to see what the text says that will let you know whether or not the word horse is an accurate translation of whatever that translator was translating. And when you do that for the Book of Mormon, you find out that whatever the animal was that was a horse, it never does anything horse-like except eat and move.
So we don't have people riding horses or going into battle on horses in the text.
Never happens in the text. The horse never pulls anything. We assume that it does because they say the word chariot, But that's an assumption. It's not in the text. In the text, a horse moves and it eats. And the only context where we have it, where there's a list of things that are, you know, being moved along, its context is in a set of animals that are eaten. So maybe it was a food animal. Who knows? The point is, regardless of whatever we say about the horse, the text never has a horse doing a horse-like thing. So when you say that we don't know, you know, we've never seen a horse there, I would say, sure. I know that that's very different from the way, you know, most apologists answer that question, which is to say, well, they've found horse bones. In my philosophy, they could find absolutely authentic horse bones, and it wouldn't change my reading of the Book of Mormon, because the horse never does anything horse-like. Even if they had a real horse, it never altered their civilization or altered anything that happened in the Book of Mormon because of it.
Yeah, you don't have Nephi riding around on a horse, right? He's always walking.
Yeah. Yeah. Nobody does. Nobody ever
rides. And there's no Lamanites on horseback going into battle, huh?
No. The only time that the horse is mentioned in the context of battle is in the scorched earth policy, when all of their possessions are being gathered up so the Gadianton robbers don't get them. And then you have a horse as one of the things that's being moved so that somebody doesn't get it. But never shows up in any context. It never pulls anything. It never does any work. The only thing we know is that Ammon feeds the darn thing. And that's all that it says. So there is nothing in the text that would tell us that we have to translate, you know, as a horse that we understand, whatever word was there. Now, does that mean that, there was or was not a horse? What it means is the text does not give us any information, which means that as a as an item where you would say this is against the Book of Mormon, you really can't say that, because it's possible that it's only a translation, and you have to go to something else to decide whether there's a reason to believe in the Book of Mormon, and then come back to the horse question later.
Okay. All right. So that's horses. One of the things that people make fun of and that some would argue gives apologetics a bad name is the attempt to explain horses as tapirs or something to that effect. Do you have an opinion on that?
Oh, yeah. It's a different translation philosophy than mine. It's the same general concept. The idea is that when you have cross-cultural labeling of animals and you have somebody who comes in and finds a new animal, it is not unusual for them to apply a name that they understand to this new animal where the label doesn't particularly fit. So we have buffalo that we know exactly what they are, except they're not buffalo, they're bison. We have the hippopotamus, which is a river horse, and that's the literal translation of the word hippopotamus is river horse. And of course, a hippo doesn't look at all like a horse, but it was called a horse. So that is a known cross-cultural phenomenon. And what John Sorensen came up with is he said, okay, you know, this is a known phenomenon that could have happened. And if that happened, perhaps the animal they saw was a tapir and they used horse as a label. And then in his understanding of translation, the Nephites would have done the cross labeling and Joseph would have accurately translated their cross labeling. My understanding would be that regardless of what the Nephites called the thing, it was Joseph's culture that saw this animal and in his mind ended up with the translation of horse. So where the word comes from would be very different in Sorensen's translation than it would be in mine. I'm amused at all of the people who talk about riding tapirs and taking them into war and everything else, because it unfortunately shows that they have no understanding of what the actual linguistic principle is like. It's actually a debating tactic called reductio ad absurdum. You make fun of something and you can make it sound like a bad argument, even if it's a good one, if you just make fun of it enough.
Right. And to depict Daniel Peterson on a taper, you know, with the sword is actually not being at all true to the text of the Book of Mormon.
No.
Because the Book of Mormon never claims that.
No, no. And it's a process that's intended to discount the argument by using ridicule, and okay. You know, not a particularly good way to engage in discussion.
Okay. All right. What about elephants?
Same thing. I'd say it's a translation issue.
Okay.
Certainly they've seen that, you know, those animals were around, and they, you know, the textual information is at the oldest level of the Book of Mormon back into the Jaredite times. And so there's a theoretical possibility it might have carried through. But again, you have so little evidence in the text of what this elephant does that you cannot say for certain whether or not it's an accurate translation of the term or not.
Okay. How about cattle? And
same kind of thing.
Okay, yeah. Goats and swine, all the same?
All the same, yeah. I mean, anything that is vocabulary-based, you have to go to the text and say, you know, what was it? Is there anything in the text that can give me a clue as to what it was? And the answer is pretty much on anything that's based in vocabulary, you know, we just don't have a lot of good information for it.
Okay.
The one place where it does differ, though, is in metals. It is absolutely true, as Michael Coe pointed out, that we don't have evidence for metalworking as early as the Book of Mormon says it was there. I don't have a good answer for that one. That's one where I'm, you know, waiting for more information. But that's also one where I cannot say, you know, that's a labeling anachronism, because we have the metal plates. And, you know, there's absolute indication that, you know, there was something metal there. So that's one where I cannot invoke that, because the evidence says it really was metal plates.
Okay, so just to go back, so goats and swine, all the same, right?
Yep.
Barley and wheat and pollen, all the same?
All of those kinds of things, exactly the same. And what I would say on every one of them is that because it's a potential question of translation, it is one of those where you cannot make a determination on that basis. I'm not saying there aren't other reasons why you have to look at the Book of Mormon against history, but using those particular vocabulary terms doesn't allow you to say either yay or nay. And the fact that, you know, they found barley doesn't mean that the barley in the Book of Mormon is exactly, you know, what we think it might be.
Right. Okay. So sometimes I'm slow. So if we jump to metallurgy now, what's different about metallurgy from all these other things is the detail in which they go into about how they're used.
Yeah, you have him creating plates out of ore. You have them engraving plates. You know, all of those kinds of things, again, are actions that are telling you that they really are interacting with metal. And then you have the fact of the golden plates that are delivered to Joseph, some of which, you know, according to what the Book of Mormon tells us, were actually original plates that Nephi had made. So although I can agree that we don't have the evidence for metallurgy, I also have to agree that that's, you know, a point where the archaeology doesn't support what we understand of the text. And, you know, the faithful part of me has to add yet and
right.
Cross my fingers and hope we find something.
Okay, so steel swords are a problem as the archaeology current exists.
If you're talking about steel swords, frankly, I doubt that. Yeah, I'll refer people to the book. I talk about steel swords in the book, and, you know, whether or not they might have been there, and if they were there, you know, the reasons why they might not have continued. I don't think that was, we assume that if you had steel swords that therefore it would have been a revolution and you would have had steel swords all the way along, and I actually don't see that happening.
But all these battles of hundreds of thousands of people fighting with swords, that's what the Book of Mormon asserts, right?
It asserts steel swords only if you look at the Sword of Laban as the precise model that's going to happen for Nephi, and you see it only early on. Later on, you have swords, and we presume that they're steel just because of habit.
But so the text, they say swords. The text doesn't claim that.
No, the text says swords, which means it could have been something made of something entirely different. And the sword that was eventually used in Mesoamerica was a wooden club with, you know, lined with obsidian, which actually had a much sharper blade than the steel did, and was apparently much more flexible as an instrument of war. Because if the steel sword ever got dulled, it was hard to sharpen. With these other ones, you just pull the one blade out and put a new one in, and you're on your way.
Okay, so I'm finding here an ether. When's ether?
Ether is very, very early. It's prior to anything with Nephi.
Okay, so when it says made swords out of steel in
yeah,
ether, that's Brother of Jared kind of stuff?
Right. Right, that's, yeah.
But that's now, a problem, right? Because it's earlier?
Oh, yeah. I mean, as far as metallurgy, we don't have good evidence for metals prior to 700 AD.
You're saying that's a problem, but to assume that all the sword battles with hundreds of thousands of soldiers, to assume that those were all steel swords is to make a leap beyond what the text actually says.
That's correct.
Okay. Got it. And only the only mention of steel swords is sort of Nephi and earlier, no mention of steel swords after Nephi.
Right. And whether or not, you know, even at that time, you know, it's whether or not they would have continued or whether they would have created them, whether they would have, you know, whether that's just this is what we did and then we gave it up. You know, it never says that. So. The real problem, of course, from an archaeological standpoint, is that there isn't any indication of metallurgy. So even if they made them and gave them up, we have no indication that that's what happened.
Okay. And what about coins? Any showing up of metal coins that you're aware of?
Metal coins don't show up, but they also don't show up in the text. The only time you have a coin in the Book of Mormon is when you read the header of that chapter, and that header has since been replaced because it was misleading. So there are no coins in the Book of Mormon at all.
Okay, so I'm reading in Alma 11, and it says Alma 11:4? Now, these are the names of the different pieces of their gold and of their silver according to their value.
Yep.
Is that not coins?
No, it doesn't have to be. If you remember, even when they had coins and they would use the Spanish doubloon, they would use pieces and they would put it into, you know, eight pieces and have a piece of eight. So, you know, even when they were using coins at some point in time, they would use a piece. So, you know, peace simply says this is, you know, some version of this metal, and you know, only refers to coins because we assume that rather than because the text requires it.
So when it says a C9 of gold, a Cion of gold, a Shum of gold, a Limna of gold.
Yeah, it's some kind of a measure.
But using gold though, right?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And silver. So, okay, so what you're saying is, The text is claiming that metal was used for currency, but not necessarily in the shape of a coin?
You know, look at the way you phrased the sentence. I didn't say that it was used as currency. I said it was used as a medium of exchange. Later on, the Aztecs used cacao beans as a medium of exchange. And some people, in order to let us understand how they use that, have said that the cacao bean was a currency. And so, you know, you might be able to say that and use the analogy, but nobody would ever say that a cacao bean was a coin. So all of these things are mediums of exchange that are used because they have some value where someone would be able to say, I'll trade you this for that.
Right. That's, you can call that currency, right? You can call the cacao beans currency, right?
Many people have, yeah. And calling them currency still, although it gives you the concept of the way they were used, saying that they were therefore coins, you know, makes a jump. So coins are currency, but, you know, cacao bean is currency as well.
Okay, so you're saying gold and silver used as currency, not necessarily as coin.
Right.
And what shape would they have taken if not in coin shape?
Well, the Aztecs used a copper, they called it a copper axe, but it was actually, if you think of maybe a long, skinny mushroom, a chisel that has a really thin slice taken off of it. You know, that's what they used as a copper currency. In fact, I've got two of them sitting on my wall that I'm staring at that I was given as a gift. But yeah, so I mean, they're not shaped like coins at all. And you know, here you have, of course, much later. But here is a copper currency that, let's see, one of them I'm guessing is about 8 inches long and about an inch and a half wide and extremely thin. So has nothing to do with the coin, but it was a metal currency.
But were gold and silver even being shaped and smelted during Book of Mormon times?
There is no archaeological evidence that they were during that time period.
Okay. All right. Okay. Got it. So metal is a potential problem.
Yes.
And you're holding out hope that, well, right. I guess for a believer, it doesn't matter because God's purposes will all come to pass whether or not evidence ever shows up to support any of this, right? But from an archaeological standpoint, it would be nice if...
It would be nice. It's not, you know, essential. And certainly at some point in time, if they ever do find evidence of this, everybody's going to say, wow, isn't that great? And nobody will say that proves the Book of Mormon. They'll just say, well, we have metal earlier than we thought in Mesoamerica.
Well, people at Fair and Farms might say that, right?
Oh, yeah, I'm sure they will. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Well, how about the wheel?
Wheels are never mentioned in the Book of Mormon. Don't have any wheels in the Book of Mormon. You have a chariot.
Okay.
And by implication, the chariot has a wheel, but it never says that. And since we don't know how a chariot moves, we're simply taking our assumption and putting it into the text when we talk about a wheel.
Okay. So wheels are never mentioned.
Nope.
Okay. All right. Well, let's see. Any other, I guess we could talk about, we're not going to talk about food because that's kind of similar. What about the argument that a lot of things that should be there, like turkeys and cocoa beans and jaguars, aren't there? That it's all domesticated New England stuff. I guess you're going to say that goes to Joseph's.
Same kind of thing. Yeah. It's all in the vocabulary, and it's one of those points where you say, because it's a translation, I don't know how to take any of those terms. So I can't use them either for or against the Book of Mormon. I have to kind of set them aside and say, I've got to judge the Book of Mormon on something more substantial than vocabulary. Just like I can't say that that the Book of Mormon can't be true because the French word adieu is in there. It's translation, folks. You know, English wasn't the original language. So vocabulary is something that we can't use, either for or against until you've gone and done something else. So you've got to judge the Book of Mormon on something other than that before you deal with those particular issues.
Okay. All right. So geography. Where in the heck did it take place? A lot of people say there's just no geography that maps to the geography that's described in the Book of Mormon.
Yeah, and half of the people, I suppose, that say that haven't really looked. Half of the other half, I suppose, have competing geographies. There's only one that I've been able to see that actually fits with a very stringent reading of both the text, the nature of the geography, the topography, so that all of the ups and downs are in the same places, the hydrology so that you know where the rivers are and the rivers are in the right places. Getting all of those pieces together, the only place that that fits is in the area that we call Mesoamerica. And the part of the Book of Mormon that fits that region would cover from kind of the bottom third, let's say, of Guatemala up into the Chiapas area of southern Mexico, up into the Gulf of Mexico, and probably no further north than that, with the River Sidon being probably the Nephite name for what we call the Grijalva River. And okay, that geography actually works quite well.
And then what do you do about Camorra?
Camorra is you know, one of those interesting issues because it becomes a battle cry for so many people. There is a Camorra in the Book of Mormon, and there is a Camorra from which Joseph took plates. And the real question is, you know, are they the same hill? Well, there is a hill Camorra in the Book of Mormon, and so, you know, certainly there's a hill Camorra. The question is that Drumlin in New York the very hill Camorra around which the Nephites died and around which there were so many Jaredite battles? And the answer to that one is there certainly isn't any evidence for it. There is certainly evidence that the early saints called that hill Camorra, but they called it that hill after the fact and based on the fact that plates were taken out of it, which is kind of ironic because the textual reason that you would talk about Camorra as the place that have the plates is because Mormon says that he, you know, put plates into the hill Camorra. What's really ironic is he says, save these that I'm giving to Moroni. In other words, there were plates put into Hill Camorra except the ones that Joseph Smith got. So the ones that Joseph Smith received were never in Camorra to be taken from Camorra. So,
are you saying that the plates Joseph received were different than the ones Moroni buried?
Moroni had source plates, and then he created his record on a set of plates, and he took the sources that he read and buried them in Camorra. He took the book that he wrote and that Moroni finished, gave it to Moroni, and the plates that Moroni have, that he worked with are the ones that Joseph Smith got. And those, according to the text, were never buried in Camorra.
What happened to them?
Don't know. Moroni probably took them up to some Drumlin in New York and buried them there.
Okay, so one of the things people mock is the idea that Moroni would bury the plates in one Camorra, and then God would, like, move them to a different Camorra.
Yeah, I'd probably mock that one, too. I wouldn't believe that.
So what do you think happened?
The most parsimonious explanation is that at some point in time, good old Moroni walked a long way and buried the plates in this hill in New York because God told him that's where they needed to be so Joseph could find them.
What about the argument that they would have been too heavy for a man to carry and he could have made that big long journey and survived?
Well, Joseph carried them around and the information was they're about 60 pounds. I don't see a problem with, you know, anybody carrying a 60-pound pack or a 60-pound worth of anything. One of the things that John Sorensen found was a record of a person who actually made that trek in, I think it was the 1700s, who came from somewhere around Central America and walked basically toward New York. So we know that not only can it happen, somebody has actually done it. So knowing that someone has done it makes it much more logical that Moroni could have done it as well.
So again, I'm sorry if I'm asking you to repeat yourself. So nowhere in the Book of Mormon does it say Moroni buried the plates in the same hill Camorra that everyone fought around.
No. The one statement, you are correct, that's what I'm saying. The one statement that we have about burying things in the hill Camorra is that Mormon buried records in the hill except the ones that have become our Book of Mormon.
Huh.
It very clearly says that, you know, the plates that Joseph Smith got were not buried in Camorra. Now, somebody will say, of course, that he went back and buried them, and the text doesn't preclude that. It just doesn't say that.
Okay. So there's all this talk of a large, what is it, large geography versus small geography kind of theories. Is that right?
Yeah, hemispheric versus limited, yeah.
And why are people battling over this? What's the nature of the, what's the nature of the battle?
The nature of the battle is, I guess everybody would really like to know where the Book of Mormon took place, and everybody has different theories, and you know there are lots of them. One of them is this hemispheric theory that is probably the oldest one, which says that you know there were Nephites probably over all of North America and all of South America, and I'm reasonably certain that that was the idea that most of the early church had, even when they looked at the Stevens and Catherwood book that described all of the wonderful things they were finding in Central America, and people like Joseph Smith and even Orson Pratt would look at those and go, wow, those must have had something to do with the Nephites. They would still believe that the Nephites were in North and South America. It was a time period when they kind of accepted anything and everything pretty much uncritically, and you know, because the Book of Mormon was wonderful, therefore it wonderfully happened everywhere and explained everything. Since that time, there have been other people that have been trying to figure out where the Book of Mormon took place. You will find traditionalists who will say that, you know, because Joseph Smith believed, at least at one point in time, that it happened all over the entire hemisphere, that that's what we must believe. You'll find other people that say, well, I can find a way to make it look like it happened all in the Great Lakes area. Somebody else in Baja California, the really fascinating one in the Malay Peninsula.
Is it fascinating, or are you saying that tongue-in-cheek?
Oh, fascinating in the way the argument is presented. It's another one of those where if you, you know, look at specifics, the model cannot survive close scrutiny, but it, you know, fascinating in the attempt that was made to put it there.
Is that true about the Baja theory and the Great Lakes theory as well? As far as yeah. Your opinion is, none of those can survive.
None of them survive. There's all kinds of problems that they have, just with the geography, topography, distances between. But then when you try to put cultural information with them, then, you know, then they really fall apart.
And then large versus limited, does large stand up at all, or in your estimation?
My understanding is that Sorensen's calculation of the distances involved in the Book of Mormon is probably as rigorous as what we have, and of course cannot be precise, but gives us a ballpark of something that in its largest extent north to south would have been about 600 miles. And what I find fascinating is that gives us about the same area as Palestine. So, you know, the Book of Mormon is taking place in a number of square miles that's very, very similar to the Bible. But yeah, limited because, you know, in all of the travels from place to place, you've got human beings who have to make that trek, and we've got a certain number of days that they've done it in, and that appears to necessarily, you know, limit the distances.
Okay. And so, but it's fair to say that church leaders, prophets, you know, apostles, for what, 100 and whatever years, seem to kind of favor the large geography theory, right?
Certainly that's the theory that was the most traditional, the one that most people believed. If you look very carefully, what you'll find is that, oh, I guess it was somewhere around the late 1800s to early 1900s, there was a resurgence of people looking at the geography of the Book of Mormon, and the brethren were basically saying, nobody's agreeing on this stuff, so it's interesting, but not doctrine. And their caution was, we don't know where it's taken place. So if you look at official pronouncements where they're trying to be specific, the only specific thing they say is, there is nothing specific. If you look at the generalities and the rhetoric it's going to follow the traditional lines.
Right. But I mean, you get the sense with Joseph that he thinks everybody, every Native American's a Lamanite, right?
Oh, certainly. Yeah. And if you read Armand Moss's book, All Abraham's Children, he has a really good discussion of what that word Lamanite meant in the church and how it's changed its meaning over time. Excuse me. So that, you know, that would be, you know, a good source for people to look at if they're interested in that. But, you know, Joseph certainly would have used the term Lamanite for anybody that was a Native American. And then after the publication of the Stevens and Catherwood book, that's when he got excited about things in Central America and started saying that some of those cities must have been Lamanite or Nephite.
Okay. Okay, so as far as you're concerned, the time it takes to travel distances in the Book of Mormon alone really only leaves us with the limited geography theory, and Central America is about the only place that makes sense geographically and culturally for you.
Right. Limited because of, you know, the time. So no matter where you place it on the world, it has to be in a more limited geography. And then when you're looking for a specific geography, the one that fits best with all of the features is going to be the one that Sorensen's come up with down in Central America. Now, of course, there are competing Mesoamerican theories as well. You know, people who've lined up things in slightly different ways. And having gone through those, I still lean to Sorensen's.
Okay. Why don't we find credible remnants of Hebrew in the languages that survive in Mesoamerica? And why don't we find references to Christ and Christianity and Christian doctrine? And why doesn't any of this show up in the history books?
Okay. Certainly valid questions. And the problem really isn't even in the answer. The problem is in the question itself, because there's a presumption that we should see Hebrew in the New World, or that we should see Christian doctrines or, you know, Christian artifacts. And when you look at the, you know, actual history of how populations come together, you're not going to find that that's the expectation that we ought to have. And a lot of it is related back to the time when we assumed that, you know, the Book of Mormon explained everybody's everything. So we assumed that if, you know, the Book of Mormon people spoke Hebrew, that everybody would speak Hebrew. And in fact, there were books in the early 1700s. Josiah Priest's being one of them, was, you know, passing along the information. Oh, Boudinot was one of the guys that did it, you know, where they would say there's, you know, there is remnants of Hebrew in these native Indian languages. And so at the time of Joseph Smith, there were people who were saying that, yeah, we find Hebrew all over the place. No modern linguist would believe that. And it wasn't true then and isn't true now. It was, you know, kind of the result of what they were looking for and, you know, sort of finding something because they really didn't know what they were looking at. But when you have a really small population that enters a larger established population, history tells us that it's really, really unusual for that smaller population to dominate the language of the larger population. Even if you retain it for a while, you know, the larger population language is going to continue. So, you know, just as one example, you've got, you know, the Norman kings in France or in England. So you have a French-speaking court in England, and we speak English, we don't speak French. Now, of course, there's a lot of vocabulary that came from the French, so it's not exactly the same thing. But still, that general idea where a small group of people is mixing in with a larger group of people, with the number of people who came across the boat with Lehi, you've got maybe 40 people. And if they're landing on, let's say, the coast of Guatemala at 600 BC, archaeologically, we know of at least six sites in the foothills along the coast of Guatemala that had 1,000 people each. So you take 40 people, mix them in with, you know, a minimum of 6,000 people. You know, whose language is going to prevail? Even though they kept, you know, whatever they knew of Hebrew and whatever they knew of Egyptian, and some of those things were certainly scholarly languages, I can't imagine that they would have been the lingua franca. That would have been the language of the people. So I'm not shocked at all that the languages that we find don't have any remnant of Hebrew, because I wouldn't expect them to find one. The question of Christianity is a little different, because obviously...
Wait, I'm sorry, Okay, sorry, I don't mean to interrupt. I had you on mute, so I tried to interject earlier. And, is there anything in the Book of Mormon that suggests or that emphasizes that Lehi and Nephi joined a much larger population?
There is no direct text that says Lehi and Nephi met up with thousands of people. What you have to do is read the text and kind of read between the lines and look at the history to find out, you know, what's happening. The clearest text that's there is when Nephi is separating from his brothers, and he's saying, you know, here are the people who came with me. And of course, Laman and Lemuel are staying behind. And he names Sam and Jacob and Joseph, and names a sister or two. And, you know, names pretty much, you know, between the ones we know left with Laman and Lemuel and the ones that he names, he pretty much names everybody that we could possibly think of who would have come over on the boat and was still alive. And then he says, and everybody else who would come. So a whole bunch of people went with him that we don't know anything about, because he never tells us. So there's an indication that, you know, they must have merged with someone else. The rest of it is, again, inference. Very soon after Nephi goes up into the mountains, and again in Sorensen's correlation up into Highland Guatemala, as soon as they arrive there, they start building a city, and very, very quickly they're building a temple. When you're putting a city together, if you don't have very many people at all, you don't build public monuments. You've got to build your houses. You've got to make sure that you've got food. You don't get to have public buildings until you have a reasonably large population. So that's another indication that there must have been a much larger population that early. There are other indications that you have where, again, if you're reading the text and looking at what's happening and what the background would be, where the only reasonable explanation is that there were other people there that were present. But the text never specifically says that.
Doesn't that feel a little bit like a stretch, though? Like, I mean, shouldn't the book say, yeah, we built this city, but then these weirdos that spoke a totally different language, these savages that, you know, used clubs or and had turkeys whatever, you know, shouldn't it give some give us something that speaks to these massive populations that likely existed, millions of people?
And there is, again, the sort of the problem of imposing our assumptions of what something should have been like on an ancient text. You know, we assume, obviously, that they should have mentioned that. Now, the real question is,
It's fair. Isn't that fair?
It's certainly a fair question to ask. The question then becomes, is it a fair requirement? Can we say, because it is not there, that there's something wrong with the Book of Mormon? And in that case, you have to look at it and, you know, look at a couple of things. One of them is the beginning that we have in the Book of Mormon is this Book of Nephi. According to the story that the text tells us about the Book of Nephi, it isn't the first book that Nephi wrote. He wrote a history. And then he specifically says, what I'm writing now isn't a history. Now, there's all kinds of reasons for going through First Nephi and looking at its structure and what it's doing and why it's written the way it is. But back to the question of, you know, should he have mentioned something? If he did, it should have been in those other plates and isn't the reason why he wrote this one. So the fact that it's not there doesn't really tell us much, because that wasn't the reason why Nephi wrote the text that we have. He wrote another book that was specifically about history, which, if he were going to mention it, would have been the place. We don't even have that. The second thing is the 116 pages that were lost weren't what Nephi wrote. They were what Mormon wrote. And so the question would then be, would it have been something that Mormon thought was really important? And the answer to that is probably not, because he's been in the, you know, his people have been in the New World for 1,000 years. He doesn't have to explain to anybody else that there are people around, because they know it. So Mormon has no reason to do it. Nephi has no reason to do it. We really wish it were there, but modern scholars wish lots of things were in ancient documents, and unfortunately, we don't get what we want. We get what they gave us.
Well, I see your point, and I guess you concede that the questions are fair ones, right?
Oh, they're absolutely fair. What would not be fair is to say, because I don't get the answer that I think I should have had, that that's an indictment on the Book of Mormon, because then that's taking a fair question and presuming that there's only one possible answer to it, which would not be fair.
Right. Someone, I posted on Facebook, I asked people to offer questions, and one guy just wrote in, ask him if he can name any other civilizations that have simply disappeared off the face of the earth without at least leaving some trace of their existence. What would you say to Craig?
Can I tell you that somebody has disappeared and we don't know anything about them, and tell you exactly who it is that we don't know anything about? No. Now, let's go back to the rest of the question, though. What the question is asking is, it is presuming that I cannot find anything that materially describes a Nephite. And that goes back to the question of expectations. What would a Nephite city look like? What would a Nephite house look like? What does a Nephite pot look like? We started earlier with the question of Christianity. And it's a really important one, because we know that there is Christianity being taught in the Book of Mormon, and yet we don't seem to find it. Now, of course, if you read the early Spanish fathers and you read the right ones, they were finding it all over the place. But I think there's a different reason for that. But archaeologically,
that's the parallel fallacy you talked about.
Yeah, exactly. But archaeologically, we don't find, you know, this evidence of Christianity. And the real problem there is, what would New World Christianity look like? Well, the question then is, what does Old World Christianity look like? Well, artistically, it pulled themes that were already available in the art of the time and incorporated them and adopted them. So Old World Christianity, although we have come to understand it as Christian art, began as adopted pagan art. So the earliest representations of Jesus Christ looked a lot like Apollo, not like the, you know, the beatific bearded man that we see in pictures now, which some people think might have been, you know, based on Zeus in the temple of Zeus. But, you know, early on it was Apollo, even so much that you'd have the image of Apollo with the sheep on the shoulder, and that would become an image of Christ. Other things that become an image of Christ are loaves and fishes, which you would understand if and only if you know that story in the Bible. But if you're not sure about that story, and you just see a picture of bread and fish, you're looking at dinner. So the problem is, you know, when we start looking for Christianity, all of the symbols that we would recognize as Christian post-date the Book of Mormon's departure from the Old World by 600 years. So you've got 600 years where there's a complete separation in iconographic representation at a time when, if you're going to borrow something, now what you're borrowing from is coming from a completely different iconographic system than it is from the Old World. So you might have pictures of Christ in, you know, some mural somewhere, and you might look at it and say, boy, that looks like the god so-and-so. And the Nephites would have said, well, no, that's a picture of Christ. How would we know? Well, how did you know when you looked at a picture of Apollo if it was Apollo or Christ? So we're making assumptions about what should be there rather than understanding what the actual historical situation would have been. So do we have, Nephites that have vanished without leaving trace? Oh, I doubt it. I'm pretty sure that we've got people who have dug up Nephite cities. The problem is we can't say that they were Nephite cities, just like if someone were to, dig up Albuquerque 1,000 years from now, I'm not sure they could tell that, a Mormon lived in my house and a non-Mormon lived in the house next door. They couldn't do it by the shape of the house. They couldn't do it by the car I drive. They couldn't do it by the pans I cook in. There's just a lot of things that are going to survive that are built on material culture that is indistinguishable from my neighbors.
And so it's fair for people to say that those things should be traces that show up. And it's also, you're saying it's fair to also say that it's unfair to expect that always to be the case.
No, what I'm saying is it is always fair to say that we expect that people will leave traces. What is not fair is to say that because the trace doesn't look like we think it should look, that therefore it doesn't represent a Nephite.
And that would probably be the way that you would handle the DNA concerns, the fact that you don't find DNA in Native Americans that scholars would tie back to to Jerusalem. Instead, you find markers that would tie back to Asia or Mongolia or people that would have come over the Bering Strait. A typical apologist response would be, how do we know what Hebrew or Israelite DNA would have looked like in 1600 BC, right?
Right.
And why would we expect Native Americans now to have Israel DNA when they would have been subsumed by the larger population anyway?
Right. And all of the, what people forget about the DNA studies is that they are reductive. The more you go back into the past, the more they reduce variations into consistency. And so you had people that came up with, oh, we found the mitochondrial Eve. And, we found this one woman and we go back to that one woman. Well, that sounds like you've got one woman and everybody's descended from her. That one woman at the time she lived would have been surrounded by thousands, maybe tens of thousands of other women. It's just that their DNA or their mitochondrial DNA did not survive. So, all these things do is tell you where the trends are of the surviving DNA. It doesn't tell you about anybody whose DNA didn't survive. And so, using it again as a negative, saying, I'm not finding anything that's really obviously Israelite, therefore there were no Israelites, goes far, far beyond the evidence and what the evidence was even designed to do.
Right.
Now, I do have to come back to one thing because we were talking about Michael Coe. There were two things in the things that Dr. Coe was talking about. One of them, we're not finding these specific things. And, of course, we've talked about vocabulary, anachronisms as the reason why I'm not terribly worried about those. But there is something else that he was very strong about, and I think important for everyone to understand because it's a shift in, again, perception of the Book of Mormon. What he was talking about is we can go back to the Maya, and for as far back as we can understand, they were Maya. We go back to the Olmec, and for as far back as we go, they're Olmec. We never see a time when the Olmec, were once Hebrew and became Olmec. And I think that's an important distinction in, first of all, the nature of the evidence, and secondly, the way we perceive the Book of Mormon. I know of many people who've done work on the Book of Mormon who, if not explicitly, implicitly, still believe that all of New World civilization was caused because these sophisticated Nephites came over and gave them culture. And Ko is reacting against that idea. And I would agree with him. I don't think there's any evidence of it. I don't see any need for it. I don't think that suggests that there were no Nephites or were no Lamanites. What it does is say that we have to understand that there were cultural processes and material culture and intellectual culture that was already in place when the peoples of the Book of Mormon showed up. And what I've done when I was working on the six-volume commentary was take that background and say, you know, can we see those historical pressures and those cultures reflected in the concerns and the issues that the Book of Mormon talks about? And I think we do see them there. So if you want to talk about archaeology, I guess I see sort of textual archaeology in the Book of Mormon that says that the Book of Mormon took place in Mesoamerica. I don't necessarily see material artifacts that say Hebrews were in Mesoamerica. But then again, I don't expect to find them.
But it would make sense that they would be there. The probabilities would be that artifacts or DNA or markers or cultural markers, the probabilities would lead us to expect remnants and artifacts, right?
What the probabilities tell you is that whoever the Nephites were, they left some indication of where they lived. You know, they had houses, and the houses left remnants. They had pots, and they left pots. But as a people who was coming from a different climate, a different set of natural resources, and coming to a new world where there were different foodstuffs, different animals, different dangers, different climates, different sources of pots, different fashions, and certainly all of us have been in the situation where something that, you know, we originally think is a little bit strange, a couple of years later after seeing it becomes high fashion and we wish we had one. You know, that's what's happening with the Nephites. They become enculturated into Mesoamerica, and their material culture, the kinds of things that you leave on the ground, would be very similar to what everybody else had. So did they leave any remnants of who they were? Sure. You know, can you look at them and say, well, you know, that certainly wasn't appropriate to the area and must have come from the old world? No, heavens no. And particularly when we start looking at things that after the Book of Mormon's been in the New World for 400 or 500 years, there's every reason to believe that the cultural pressures would have had a similar material culture, particularly with the trades. Just like, you know, wherever I go in the United States, houses look, you know, regionally similar to each other and are not differentiated by religion.
Hmm. I hear you. And there's still a part of me that realizes that somehow, you know, Latin shows up in English today and Greek, I don't know, that the English that we have today, you can trace it back and find remnants of other civilizations aggregating into the English that we use today. And you can, you know, you can go to other historical sites and find plates or tablets or weapons or, you know, buried fossils that match whatever history that we have. And so while theoretically and philosophically, I think I can get what you're saying, it just feels like there's a material difference between what the Book of Mormon claims and asserts and what the archaeological evidence show. It seems like you're relying on those exceptions to a much larger degree, and you're sort of discounting the probabilities to a much larger degree than you would under other, let's say, neutral or scientific circumstances. Isn't that fair to say?
No, not at all. And the reason is, again, if you go back to, you know, the people who came over in the ship with Lehi, let's say there's 40 people. And soon after they arrive, those 40 people, and let's make a nice even division, split into Lamanites and Nephites, and there were 20 of them in each group. How influential are 20 people going to be if they're in an area where we know archaeologically that in the immediate vicinity you know, there were a minimum of 6,000 and probably a lot more. And by the time the 20 that were Nephites went up into Highland Guatemala, certainly a much larger population. You know, exactly how much influence are those 20 people going to have? How much is their language going to be retained for 1,000 years and influence other languages? You know, you're putting really, really heavy weight on some really thin threads if you're expecting 20 people to have, you know, a material and linguistic influence that's going to last that long. I know why people expect it, because we're so excited about the Book of Mormon. We assume that it should have done all these things. But, you know, again, pretty dispassionately from the nature of history, you're not going to get 20 people that are going to cause that kind of cultural revolution, particularly when they come from the wrong place, don't know the material culture, and have to learn how to deal with this new world. They're in the mode of receiving, not giving.
Okay. All right. Well, I think we've covered this point, and it leads me to a question that that I think touches on what I'm trying to get at, but maybe looking at it from a different angle. I mean, if you go to reputable non-LDS archaeologists, right? Mm-hmm. They may grant philosophically and theoretically everything you're saying about what we should or shouldn't expect from archaeology or linguistics or DNA. But at the same time, if you said read the Book of Mormon and how credible is this, what do you think the response would be for most, you know, PhDs in archaeology, anthropology, linguistics, you know, the focus of Mesoamerica? What do you think their response would be?
Well, the immediate response would be, I don't have time to read that thing.
And then let's say that they actually read it. Then what
you know,
would they say?
If they read it, again, it would depend on sort of the way that you read it. If I read it in English and I read horse and I choke on the word horse, excuse me, you know, I'm going to say, yep, horse, yep, not there, and it's in. They're going to reject it. What I am hoping would happen is if someone goes through you know, sort of the historical way that I've put things together in the commentary that says this is how it fits into that area, what I would expect someone to say at some point in time is, okay, I can see why you would believe that. I certainly doubt that anybody would say, okay, yeah, therefore I believe the Book of Mormon is true. I think the best statement that we would ever get from, you know, a non-Mormon specialist would be, okay, I understand why you believe that, and that's probably as good as it'll ever get.
But the likely response, if you forced 100 anthropologists to sit down and read the book, and you didn't let them get up until they were done, and then they got done, what do you think the distribution of responses would be? Where would the mean fall? Like, wouldn't it be, this is ridiculous, you just wasted X hours of my time, this is a fantasy fairy tale, and I can see through plausible deniability why you could say this is theoretically possible, but would any of the responses be, or would any significant number of the responses be, wow, I'm going to start incorporating Book of Mormon stuff into my research because it's so, this is really fascinating and probable, you know, this provides new data to help us understand Mesoamerican archaeology better. Would there, you know, how much of that would there be? Do you think?
Well, I mean, one of the questions is you would have to ask me whether I think that understanding the Book of Mormon this way helps me understand Mesoamerican archaeology better, and I would say no, it doesn't. I think the Nephite record is a record just like that of the Jews, of sort of a little bit more of a bywater in the cultural history. The Bible is a history of the people that were the doormats to the Egyptians and the Hittites and, you know, Assyrians and Babylonians. So it doesn't surprise me at all that the record that we have of the Nephites was not of an influencing group of people, but one that, you know, was on the receiving end of the major trends. And archaeologists are going to be following the major trends. We don't have enough information to follow the minor ones. We simply don't have the data available. The rest of it is, it's kind of a loaded question, because if you start with the presumption that, you know, there is no God and that this couldn't have happened, You know, how many are going to be convinced? Well, those who are convinced are probably going to believe the Book of Mormon and be baptized and therefore not be qualified as non-Mormon archaeologists anymore. And so, you know, you're probably going to find, you know, ideological divisions. So, yeah, is there anything about this that will compel anybody's belief? No. Is there enough information in the Book of Mormon that when you read it against that area, you can see how the Book of Mormon fits into that area, that time period, those cultures, those cultural trends that are happening in exactly the time period that the Book of Mormon states? Yeah, you can. Certainly right. Never enough to compel belief.
Right, but if you were to ask 100 anthropologists, is the Book of Mormon credible? Is the text of the Book of Mormon credible or probable? Or probably historical, based on what you know about anthropology and archaeology, don't you think the overwhelming response would be no, not credible?
You know, if you put the question that way, I could also say what would happen if I asked, you know, a few hundred airline pilots what they thought of it. They'd also think it wasn't credible. It's not necessarily the correct question to ask because of the prejudices going into it. And in many cases, the difficulty of reading the text without prejudice.
Okay. So you agree that they would probably come back overwhelmingly as saying not credible, but you say that is...
you really want me to say that, don't you?
Well, no, I you know, this comes not from a place of trying to do gotcha. This comes from a place of, like, being taught that the age of the earth is 6,000 years, and the dinosaurs were put on the earth by Satan to deceive mankind. I guess I've got a little bit of a frustration that I was raised to hold science in low regard and to dismiss science and to look on scientists with suspicion and you know, ill intent on their part because so often what science has discovered, age of the earth, fossil record, whatever, you know, conflicts with traditional religious narratives. And so let's throw the scientists under the bus instead of reflect back on our narratives. Now, I have to give you credit because you've looked hard at the science, and I don't see you throwing scientists under the bus at all. I see you respecting science. But at the same time, I think that if we're going to respect science, we need to, you know, it's a fair question to say, you know, there's this rumor that the Book of Mormon is so awesome that, you know, the National Geographic Institute or the Smithsonian used to send their archaeologists out with the Book of Mormon to help them find archaeology digs, right? In other words, the Book of Mormon's so awesome that scientists use it to help, you know, do better science. And that's obviously been proven to be ridiculous, but the flip side is also, you know, worth exploring, and that's that let's take credible scientists who understand linguistics and archaeology and anthropology and DNA, and let's have them read the Book of Mormon and say, what's the probability that this bears any resemblance to the data, and see what their response would be. I'm not trying to, like, trap you, but can you see why people would want to sort of say, does it pass the smell test? Forget plausible deniability. Is the book credible from an archaeological, historical, linguistic, you know, anthropological sort of point of view? It's a fair question, right?
Yeah, it's a fair question, but one that almost requires that I sort of stand outside of history and anything I know of human populations to answer it. For example, Einstein comes along and has this theory of relativity. If within 5 or 6 years of the publication of the theory of relativity, you were to line up physicists and ask them to review it and tell you whether or not they thought that was any good, do you know what the answer would have been? They'd have dismissed it entirely, and required, you know, some proof that they... Yeah, that took a long time coming before they were able to accept it. So, you know, the fact that based on the way we understand the world, if we come up against something new, You know, what's our response going to be? You know, history tells us that you're going to interpret the world the way you understand it and not according to this new information. So, yeah, if they were to read the text in English and not have any other coaching on how to look at the text or to read it as translation literature, yeah, I can't imagine very many of them saying that sounds like a Mesoamerican book. Nevertheless, I think if they, you know, would look at some of the kinds of things that I'm pointing out in the text, they'd say, well, yeah, okay, that does. But it still isn't going to be anything where they'd say, oh, therefore I'm going to change the way I do archaeology. Because, again, there's nothing in the Book of Mormon that dictates, you know, that mainstream of, the, you know, the flow of history in Mesoamerica. What was happening in the Book of Mormon was reactive to that mainstream, not, you know, causative of it.
Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Stories. Music today was provided by the Saber Rattlers. Check them out at saber-rattlers.com. The Mormon Stories logo was generously donated by StudioCase.com. Thanks for listening.
Come, come, ye saints, no toil nor labor fear, but with joy wend your way. Though hard to you this journey may appear, grace shall be as your day. 'Tis better far for us to strive our useless cares from us to drive, to the sand joy your hearts will swell. Should we die before our journey?